Welcome to this episode of the Level Design Podcast, in which we flick the enable multiplayer toggle button in our game engine with Mark Lindell from Google Cloud. Let's get on with the show. Hello, 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 and welcome to the podcast. In this episode, we're going to be talking to the wonderful Mark Lindell from Google Cloud about multiplayer engines. Joining me in this wonderful episode is Jonathan Wilson, freelancer for Us Two Games, Rob McLaughlin, the lovely lead designer from The Chinese Room, and Mark Mandel. Don't get confused with another Mark. Don't worry, his voice will be slightly different than mine. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Hello, nice to be here again.
And let's hear Mark. This is Mark Drew. I am Mark Drew from Command Studio. And this is Mark Mandel from Google Cloud.
I am Mark Mandel from Google Cloud. Yes, indeed. Thank you for having me.
See, there
I think there's enough of a deviation there. Yeah, there's enough of a difference there for people to be able to distinguish. Yeah,
perfectly.
It's fine.
I was just waiting for Mark to do like a spot-on impression of my accent.
I don't think I can do that. I'll just try and drop my voice another several octaves so that we have a deep Mark and a higher level Mark. I don't know, something.
Well, I mean, I think that the differentiation is there. Jonathan, you are now at Us Two. Is this true?
It is true, yeah.
As a freelancer, right?
Yes.
I think in the last episode we didn't say it. Did we say it?
I think we briefly mentioned it.
That you were a freelancer, that he had been unleashed.
Yeah, but not necessarily where I was going. Because I think we recorded the last episode before I actually joined them officially. It was like a 3-day overlap. I did a bunch of content stuff on the Friday and Saturday in between changing jobs, which is like, I can't say anything, but yeah, that's fine.
But anyway, back on topic. Well, we brought the lovely Mark Mandel here, who last time I saw you, it was either in Minneapolis or in Australia. And then a lot has changed since, I think. Was it CF Objective Down Under?
I'm actually trying to remember. I honestly genuinely can't remember the last time.
And I'm being doing the old man thing that makes other people like, oh my God, when was the last time I saw you? And both of us sit there staring at the wall. And we've kind of had, we worked in the same industry, but then Mark went over to Google and started doing crazy game stuff for the Google Cloud. And I kind of didn't go to Google, but then started doing some crazy game stuff for myself. And, we've been eyeing each other across like planets. And one conversation...
Sounds very romantic when you put it like that.
I know.
Across planets.
Across continents. A continent.
Across a very large pond.
Yeah. I have been playing the Outer Wilds, so I've been thinking about planets crossing each other, and I was really surprised because you said, "Oh no, I'm, working for Google, and now we're sponsoring GDC at the time," because I was thinking of going to GDC, right? And I was like, it got me thinking, and we've done this podcast, and I was like, I have to bring Mark Mandel on because there is a running joke that to enable multiplayer, you just toggle the enable multiplayer switch in your game engine, and that's all you do. Right? That's all you have to do.
Yeah, yeah. It's like Photoshop. You just make things pretty.
Yeah, it's almost as bad as the build game, but
yeah,
it's like you just press it, happens. That's it. It's all you have to do.
And it goes into Steam, and that's it. Job done. And what I wanted to talk and explore and maybe make people that listen to this podcast understand it, is the amount of work that actually goes on behind the scenes and the kind of different technologies that have to happen for you to get owned by that noob, in whatever game you've been playing. So, Mark, would you like to give us kind of a bit of a background about what you're doing at Google Cloud?
I work for Google Cloud. If people aren't familiar, it's a public cloud. We're basically people who own computers for other people to run software on them.
So they're not actually in the cloud. There's a legal requirement for me to make that joke.
Yes, it's absolutely reasonable. And what I do is I lead the developer relations team that works on the gaming part of that public cloud. And in that capacity, I also release a few open source tools for backends for gaming. I'm wearing one of the t-shirts today for that. That's how you know it's a real product, because it's a t-shirt.
Yep. As long as it's a t-shirt, then it's real, right?
Exactly. I work on one of the projects that we work on and assist and sort of do some advisory stuff around some of the other open source stuff we have and various other sundries in that too, and work with customers and talk at conferences and all that kind of fun stuff. So basically, Yeah, I focus on backends for multiplayer games, both in the proprietary sense of like Google Cloud and Google Cloud Technologies, but also in the open source sense of like, how do we build a better foundation for people who want to build backends for multiplayer games? On top of that, and sort of into that sort of more backend education advocacy role, technically last year, Ed Pereira and I, Ed's from Naughty Dog, working with GDC, we started the online game tech summit at GDC. COVID happened, so it didn't happen that year, but it's going to happen in virtually this year. So just helping grow education around backend systems for multiplayer games, or just actually generally backend systems for games, for any sort of online connected game, and sort of help grow that. So I do summit advisory work for that as well.
That's a massive challenge, I think, if you don't already have existing infrastructure. Like I was trying to remember which one it was. It's either PlayerUnknown that was showing like how many people are playing this at the moment. And the first thing that came to mind wasn't like all these PCs everywhere. It's like what servers are handling the replication for that many people online at the same time? And especially when you've got like, you know, was it millions of sessions happening at the same time? What kind of scale that has to happen?
Yeah. Do you want to go down the rabbit hole? Like, so it depends on sort of multiplayer game you're building. Yes. And we can sort of talk about that
down
kind of stuff too.
Down the rabbit hole. That's what this show is.
Yeah. Okay. So yeah, I was going to say, we can go down that rabbit hole. And I think that's from like looking at your podcast and like the stuff that I've seen, like the interesting question, I think maybe for some of your listeners is going to be like, how does the design of my multiplayer game affect the technological requirements that I have? And
right,
like the costs therein and the skills that I need on my team to be able to have those sort of conversations and the trade-offs therein, right?
Because you could go at your thing from a leaderboard, right? Like an online leaderboard. Yes. But even that has got like repercussions, right? Because like if you have an online leaderboard, you have to have some sort of login, which means that you have some sort of, you know,
security,
registration and security and like, you know, knowing who you are when you're playing, etc.
There's that. There's also a lot of fun things around build versus buy. There are mm-hmm. a lot of backend systems and backend companies that do this kind of stuff. And depending on the skills in your team, the size of your company, how much control you want over each individual component, also can also dictate which bits you want to build, which bits you want to buy, which bits you want to have in-house or externally, et cetera, et cetera. And like how much control over that pipeline that you want to have is fun. It's like, Mark, you and I worked, you know, in wider tech. It's kind of like what size is your company? If you're an enterprise company, your needs are going to be very different than if you're a smaller company. By the same token, if you're an indie, you might have very different needs and technological skills to a AAA, for example, and everything in between.
Yeah, I mean, an indie, you're not going to be able to have a tech team that's there waiting for you to like, for when you suddenly have that burst of however many players when you go live, right? It's like, and you're not going to be able to afford that kind of hardware all the time, and this is where the scalability of cloud services comes in, right?
Yeah, it actually becomes an interesting one. Like just thinking about this in terms of I work for Google Cloud, who's like our target market, right? Like who would be a good end user for that kind of stuff. The phrase I like to use when I think about like we're talking, so let's talk build versus buy. I think that's a fun thing, right? So say you're coming up and you're like, I want to build an online game. We can talk about different types and some fun stuff in there too. But the phrase I like to use is like, if you're on the build side, that's where you have the skills to support the platform that's going to power your multiplayer game. If you're AAA, that's usually an easier thing because you probably have an operations team, that kind of fun stuff. If you're a mid-size or like indie, usually what I tell people as a general rule of thumb is like, if the core competency of your game is to have an online multiplayer component, then you probably should have those skills in-house because those are the things that are going to tell you what you should build and what you should buy and do that kind of stuff. And it's probably really important that you optimize on that and make sure it is a smooth experience. If you're going to have like a lightweight thing or like a little bit of an online presence, maybe you want to do some just like online analytics or like maybe something that's just kind of turn-based or something that's not as fast-paced or anything like that, you can probably buy that and like not have to worry about it as much. But yeah, if online's a big part of your game, like get a bunch of cloud devs together and like and really own that piece.
Kind of by that, like you said, you would recommend if indie team was building this multiplayer experience, you would kind of, and that's the core of their game, you would recommend them having that kind of team setup in-house. Do you find that's always the case, and like most indies like need that information, or they just can't scale up quick enough?
That is an excellent question. I will sort of 45 degree angle off that and say, yeah. There are, as far as I see it, like the work that I do with a lot of different companies and a lot of different mm-hmm. communities and games, there are basically two paths that I see to learning about how to build scalable games. One, you build a scalable game and it gets really good and a lot of people like it and it's a trial by fire. Or two, you join an existing company that's already doing it and you learn their way of doing it. Mm-hmm. The education around this space is absolutely appalling. And I stand by that. And that's one of the things I want to kind of help grow and change. And there's a lot of game devs running around looking at how web tech stuff is built and like mobile tech stuff and being like, how do I apply that to games in a way that makes sense for games and games launches and the different patterns that apply there.
Yeah.
So yeah, some of them are just like, YOLO, we're going to build a multiplayer game and things are going to break and we'll work it out as we go. Yeah. And some of them work really well. We've got some stuff where like some good mid-tier orgs find some good partners to work with that already have the experience. There's a few different avenues there. You can definitely get consultants in if you have the budget at different tiers to kind of help you out. Or if there's an existing services company that you can work with, that you're like, oh, they already give us what we need and I can probably take advantage of that.
So I guess like with that, do you think stuff like early access can help you weather that storm? Like if you're limiting like the uptake, because that's what I've seen anyway, and all these multiplayer sensations are things that explode on Twitch. They usually start in like a beta or early access form. They get rammed, usually break, but they get away with it because they can see it's not done yet. It's early access, the full release is coming later on.
I mean, there's always those trade-offs, right? Like early access, you're kind of showing your hand a little early, like there's that kind of stuff, but at the same time you get the chance to like tweak your whole game experience, and that's kind of great too. I think early access is great. Anything you can do to, even if it's just private betas, whatever. Unfortunately, production is always going to be like production, like launch traffic is always going to be different from everything else anyway.
Yeah.
Like there's always going to be.
You can't replicate it, right? You can't like artificially like make, when a game goes live, it could get slammed.
The things I do see are a lot of companies will do bots. That's usually a big way of doing it. So they'll spin up a bunch of bots and hit their own services with it. And that definitely will mitigate some things. Early access definitely helps as well. But yeah, that production workload, I mean, it's like every piece of software in the world, right? As soon as you put real users in front of it, you're like, what are you doing? Why are you doing that? Why are you drinking like your glass, like your cup of thing from like the wrong side of it? Like just fine.
And that's
just the reality. One thing I have seen some companies do that I really like, and I think actually is really cool, especially in the beginning, is having queuing services in place.
Okay.
So, initially limiting the number of people who can come in the game. And so you always get a subset of like, okay, so, you know, 100 people can have a really good experience in this game, but another 100 maybe by sitting in the wings rather than 200 people who all have an awful experience. And then you have a chance to slowly grow that up. And putting that infrastructure in the beginning, I think is actually really kind of cool and gives you that sort of thing. And then that's slowly, you know, something you can take away as you go. But I haven't seen a lot, but I've seen a few companies do that. And I think it's actually, it's a good idea. Actually, I really like that.
Well, I mean, like the queuing system though, it's like I know you can't do much because most of the game will be running in the background trying to load, but that almost offers you an avenue to have another feature in your game. Like there could be a gimmick in that queue or whatever, whether right. It's an overlay or it's a loading screen. It's like you can layer it into the game and actually build it into the overall experience. So it doesn't feel I'm waiting for this thing to spin around and for a spot to become available to let me in. Yeah.
You ever played the Dino game in offline Chrome?
Oh yeah, jump in.
Oh really? If you haven't played it, it's a little Dino. I don't know if this is true, so don't quote me on this, but I've heard it's probably one of the most available games in the world because it's on every Chrome device. If you're offline, there's a little Dino game you can play that you jump over cactuses.
I see this in games anyway. It's a missed opportunity. You make your load screen entertaining or interactive.
Yep.
It's not so bad now with next gen because load screens have been cut down dramatically, but it's like they got very long last generation and were very boring.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not sure if this is apocryphal, but I seem to remember a discussion on Twitter recently about a recent games patent thing about Shadow of Mordor that apparently is it Namco, didn't they patent loading screen minigames for like Ridge Racer or something, so basically no one else could do it to have a little mini game on their loading screen. I don't know if that's actually true anymore.
Possibly that that would explain it.
Well, I mean, in theory, you can do it. They, even though they patent it, you just have to, like, pay them money.
Pay them, yeah.
Which is yet another thing. And they'll go like, well, okay.
I guess maybe calling it a game's a bit extreme. So, like, if you ever played Devil May Cry, you used to be able to shoot. And you could like break and crack the glass in the bottom corner of your screen while the chapter was loading. Even something as simple as that, it's just something interactive to keep the player engaged while they're doing it.
I'm playing a bucket ton of Assassin's Creed Valhalla, and like Assassin's Creed, you're always able to just like run around and shoot arrows into like the nether for just no reason whatsoever, but it was nice.
I mean, one thing that I find funny, because I don't know if this is showing how the sausage is made, but loading screens in Unreal especially are literally a level in Unreal that is like getting stuff ready in the background before, just with a front on it. So you have got access to the full game engine, don't you? And what that's, I always find funny, that one of the things as well was, and I might get this wrong, so please correct me if I'm wrong, and I'm sure people in the comments will correct me very quickly. Wasn't it The Division had like a loading screen, which was like you waiting in a lobby, you're literally waiting in a lobby, and suddenly like too many people started appearing in it, and suddenly the lobby getting really overcrowded and you couldn't walk around because there's too many people.
So that was the hub space,
right?
And this was The Division 1, and it's where you, everyone, when you loaded into the world or loaded into your safe house,
right,
it was there, and that just became really overpopulated, so people couldn't get through the door.
Yeah.
They were all trying to go through the same door frame, and they just all built up in the room.
It was like
really nasty griefing by accident, like you griefed yourself. That's fantastic. Yeah.
So
that takes me back to Rocket Arena and Rocket Arena 2 back in the Quake days, where you would have an 8-player server and 6 of you would be literally standing in the map behind unbreakable windows watching the duels go on and behind the windows.
Wow.
So you'd all be waiting there jumping around with no weapons, sort of jumping and talking and watching these two people fight. And then when someone died, you got to go in. And then if you won, you stayed on in the arena. I'd say bring back more of that. It's lovely to watch other people play. I mean, the millions of hours that people spend doing it on Twitch is testament to that.
It's better than just like we said, it's better than just waiting, right? It's like actually being in the game, even if you're watching as a participant, waiting to be released.
One thing that comes to mind, and I wanted to talk about Agonis, which is one of the open source project that you work on. But before talking about that, have you seen a rise of people coming up with multiplayer ideas over COVID? I mean, I realize this is your job and you're seeing that, because I would think that now people will be thinking of making games that they can play with other people a lot more than before.
That's an interesting question. I would say overall, and there's plenty of stuff out there saying like gaming's on the rise because COVID, right? People are looking for escapes, and people are looking for ways to connect with people, and like a bunch of other reasons that I'm not qualified to answer about. What I would probably answer is, without actual numbers before me and complete anecdata and gut feeling, I would say I think we've seen a pretty steady rise just across the board in games in general. Mm-hmm. I don't think necessarily it's limited to multiplayer or single player, because I think lots of different people are looking for different experiences, right? Maybe I am looking to connect with other people in a play environment, or maybe I'm just looking for an escape where, you know, I harvest turnips and I don't have to talk to other people, or, and everything in between, from like super like PvP, like player versus player, to like just collaborative environments where we just do nice things and we're very wholesome with each other. Or maybe I just want to, you know, chase around an angry like duck or something, right? Like,
and there's such a lag, really, isn't there, Mark, between something happening in the games industry,
right,
in games industry responding with new games.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I think that if you took the pandemic as the trigger for you to try making a game like that, you'd still probably be working on it now, and hopefully, I don't know if your business plan depends on there being unlimited pandemics for the rest of time.
Yeah.
That's probably a bad business plan to have.
If I was a researcher and I wanted to do that stuff, I'd probably look more at like sort of the indie community, because they tend to move a little faster, and see what sort of stuff they're building there. I've definitely, like, amongst the people that I know, I'm definitely seeing a lot of games about friendship. I'm seeing a lot of games about, you know, wellness and psychological safety and like things like that. That's definitely coming out as people are looking for those kind of connections, I think.
Because you can't come up with yet another like post-apocalyptic game, because you go like, seriously, dude?
No one's making another Plague Inc. at this point. Right?
Like, have you looked outside? I don't need to see it. I can see it outside.
You can see the Left 4 Dead graffiti on the wall. they got it completely right.
Yeah, and I don't know about y'all, but like the current state of the world currently has impact over the sort of media that I consume and the sort of media that I want to consume,
mm-hmm.
personally.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of stuff that previously wouldn't have been stressful is now kind of stressful. And I'm like, I don't give me, you know, I don't want to watch a movie about a plague. I don't want to watch a movie about totalitarian regimes. I don't want to watch any of that stuff because I think, fine.
Well, yeah, that's the news. We have the news.
It's funny you say that. It's like, because I remember like last year and it was like people stopped playing The Division for a similar reason because it is like that kind of like, it is a virus that outbroke. Yeah. And like Resident Evil 3 got backlash for it as well when it came out at the start of last year because that came out just after the whole world had started going into lockdown and people were like, yeah, I can't deal with this. It's just like, it's just not. Obviously, it's very different. It's like zombies, but they're like, yeah, it's still a plague. It's still a viral outbreak.
Yeah, and just to be clear, like for every person, like this is going to be different, and like things that are going to be good for me are going to be 100%. Different for other people and stuff like that. But I think the media we're consuming as a whole has changed for all of us in different ways, which is interesting in and of itself.
I wonder if anyone else has felt that of going back to old experiences. Just to kind of get some sort of sense of normality, I started playing EVE Online again.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I haven't played in a very long time. And I wanted to ask your opinion, Mark, if you're familiar with the game.
I am not.
Yeah. About... Well, not you,
not you.
Oh, no.
Where it's such an interesting game because it has these kind of sort of shards or instances that can have several thousand players in playing at once. And despite, you know, it's not a great experience all the time. I'd say it's a stable experience, but it can be a very slow experience. I was in a battle just before Christmas that had about 6,000 players in it. And it was very, very slow.
Yeah, they do that thing where they'll slow down time to based on like how many people are in there.
That's right. They call it time dilation. So the commands get queued up. And so things actually do happen. It doesn't just all crash, but it just can take a really long time.
Is that a technical feature?
It is a technical feature, yeah. They put it in to stop the servers crashing. Okay. Well, it used to be you get to a certain point and then the servers will just die. But now it just slows everything down and puts it in a big queue. So it does work. It just takes a really long time. I wonder, Mark, where you see that kind of thing going? Do you see us moving beyond the kind of traditional player limits of, you know, you hear like 16, 32, 64 players and up as like that? Do you think we're going to get into those sort of thousands of player experiences?
So I'll answer this question in two different ways. One,
cool.
Technologically, if you want to have games with lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of players, you want to have 10,000 players, there are plenty of demos out there of people doing it in like really impressive world scale stuff. There's demos from their partner of ours, Disclaimer Improbable with Spatial OS, right? Like there's a great service for doing that kind of stuff. The other one is it Hadeon? Oh my God, who've also done similar things on like Microsoft platforms. So technologically, if you want to do that, you can do that. I will also admit game design is not my strong suit, but I also just want to say like more players is not a game mechanic. And I see this all the time, and it's you know you want to come play our game because we have 10,000 people, and I'm like, 10,000 people doing what? I live in a world with 10,000 people. Doesn't mean the world is fun.
You can't make friends with 9,999 people,
right? And so there's only so many people, like, you know, like psychological studies have shown, like there's only so many people in your immediate sphere that actually really mean anything to you as well, and like that kind of stuff. So unless there's like very, like, I'm not particularly familiar with EVE, but like, you know, if there's like combat mechanics, economic mechanics, things that make sense to have a huge number of people within your game because that ties into your mechanic, cool. But don't start with the number of players because...
No.
Like, fine. And also trying to get that many players in a game so that the game itself can be a game, that's hard. Like that's a double-ended business problem. Like you need the players in to play the game, but you also have to get the players in to get the game so that you can bring in more players. Yeah.
Because what happens if you have like three players and it's a game designed for 10,000, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, but for whatever reason, like I won't say every, that's a terrible thing to say, but I see it all the time where especially like you get students who come out of college or like someone's done their first hackathon or like game jam or something, and they're like, all right, so we're going to build an MMO and it's going to be awesome. And I'm like, you're literally picking one of the hardest problems in technical, or at least back-end game design for games. I'll limit it that way. There are tricks, I think, technically for like MMO type stuff where you can make it seem like that kind of stuff is really cool. So, like you'll see things where it looks like a big open space. Like so say you've got the big open space, like like, say, World of Warcraft type stuff, right? Like, you can just keep on running forever and it never ever ends. That's hard because you have to do fun stuff. Like, you can only really put so many people on one given machine. And so at some point you have to transfer that person from one machine to another, right? Like, you sort of divvy up your geographical spaces and that's your machine and you move it over and there's some orchestration rules. So you have to do all kinds of weird things about where that overlap is. You're essentially doing conflict resolution. You're like, who owns this object that sits between the two of us and tells it who's the real thing that does the thing?
Wow.
And that's like solvable, but not easy. And that's why there are companies that do this now. But you can also do fun things like, so you're going to sit inside this area. That's cool. And you're going to do your thing. But when you go from this area to that area, we're going to put you on a dragon for 30 seconds. And you're going to get a nice little cute cutscene, and now you're suddenly on a different server, and, like, now you're going to sit in this other area. And now it looks like it's a really big area, but, like, if you can put some sort of interstitial, some sort of animation, essentially some sort of cheat or lie in between, suddenly it's a lot easier. You're essentially doing a session-based game where, like, you and several other people in that area are all playing together for a period until all of you leave, but it looks like a big MMO-type game. So you can kind of, again, it's that how you design your game can make that sort of things a little bit easier as well.
And Improbable kind of, like, you know, cut their teeth with doing that, having, like, persistent worlds that...
Yeah. Usually nowadays, yeah, if people will come to me and they're like, I want to build an MMO, I'm like, go talk to them. Please don't do this from scratch. They will do it better than you will because they've been doing it for a long time.
Speaking of throwing numbers of players at a game, and I think what is it became its USP, does anyone remember MAG? Which was literally massively multiplayer online first-person shooter, and its selling point was you can have 256 players in a game. I think I tried it once. This is, like, back in 2010, so obviously it's, like, online technology and stuff came, like, a long way since then. But it's got that problem that you mentioned of, I don't think, like, you would ever got a game with 256 players. And like you said, you probably can't coordinate a game yourself with that many friends or that group of friends to pull 260 people. 56 people into one game, and it just felt like any standard first-person shooter, but because its mechanics weren't as strong as Call of Duty and other first-person shooters that were at the time, it kind of died, like, very quickly. I think the servers got shut down, like, 3, maybe 4 years later, like, after the game came out, so it didn't have very, like, long legs on it either.
So that's such a death knell to something like, we've shut down the servers. That's like, Bomb.
Yeah, one thing I'd be really curious about is looking, I mean, there was the huge rise in Battle Royale games, right? Like 100 people going down a wall, mm-hmm. like that kind of thing.
Mm.
I would be super curious to know, like, at the sort of advent of that idea, I know it's been around for a while, if people were like, all right, let's try this with 10. Okay, that's too small. Let's try this at 200. Okay, too many. Like 50. Meh, I don't know. And then how they resulted with, like, 100 being, like, the happy number. Or whether it was just sort of an arbitrary, they were like, we'll just do 100, it'll be fine. And they were like, it seems fine, and we stuck with it forever and whatever. I'd be really curious to know what the sort of history of that is. I'd be super curious.
I was going to say, has it always been 100, though? Because obviously Battle Royale has been around a while now. Yeah, because, like, to me, the Battle Royale genre was mods that were quite buggy in the beginning with, like, stuff like armor and PUBG. And then Fortnite was, to me, was the first polished one, right? It was the one that was less buggy, and it was kind of like, it was targeted at a very different demographic, but it did seem to be the one that kind of had everything working in order to look like this polished experience. Because every time I tried a Battle Royale before that, it did have lots of issues.
Yeah, Epic are just the polish and optimization kings, aren't they? They'll take an existing thing and they'll make the graphics incredibly optimized, they'll make the networking incredibly optimized, and a lot of that stuff, like you were saying, Mark, is behind the scenes. You don't really notice it happening because it's hidden so well, but, you know, you won't be being fed the data about a fight that's happening on the other side of the map. All you'll get from that is so-and-so killed so-and-so, but you won't know where the bullets went. It'll just be all really brilliantly done in that way.
But one of the good things, or I guess the advantages of having multiple, and I want to actually talk about Agones and what Agones does in a second, but one of the things is, like, in these kind of, let's say you manage to do, like, a multiplayer game, or even if it's not quite a multiplayer game, but multiple people are playing it, doesn't have to be at the same time, you're able to track some of the data of, like, what are the problem points and stuff like that. I'm trying to remember the people that made the Turing test, thank you. What they did, they had a whole bunch of AI bots going, running around and taking pictures and saving them to the cloud as part of their QA, which is kind of, like, simple, but if you have your own game and you have people playing it or beta testers playing, you can't be sitting on their shoulder having a look. and asking them what they thought is one was very subjective, right? But compared to like being able to just gather all that data, see what the good paths were and stuff like that. And this is where you need backends. And it doesn't seem like gameplay, but it's you know, logging and tracking and all of these server side stuff that you need.
If you look at the mobile industry, I mean, they've got this down to a science, right? And I'm seeing some of this move, you know, through the rest of the industry of PC console games and into AAA and that kind of stuff too. Because, I mean, you look at traditionally a lot of mobile games, free to play. So you're looking at things like retention rates. You're looking at what are your in-app purchase rates. Do I show people ads? Do I send them buffs to bring them back? Like, how can I, like, all that kind of stuff. They know this 100%. So even if their game isn't necessarily like I'm playing against someone either real time or async or anything like that, they're always tracking data of like, is this game balanced? Are they being too difficult here? Have they left for a while? You know, are there particular places they're getting stuck on or it's too smooth or what are their play times? Like all the stuff as much as they possibly can to try and bring you back and continue to keep you playing and keep that loop happening within that game.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to work on Total War Arena, which we partnered with Wargaming. This is when I was at Creative Assembly. And it was a sort of World of Tanks style experience, but with obviously Total War style units instead. And we were expanding a massive amount of data for how battles are being played, what the win rate was on different maps, what the win rate was with different units, how they were interacting. We had heat maps for all the maps to see where people were, where most people died and stuff. It was absolutely fascinating and it's totally useful to figure out what's going on, because otherwise you can't just rely on your own experience of it, because you're seeing such a tiny fraction of all the available games.
And you can't rely on Reddit all the time either. Having real data
because
you
just
helps.
Get the angry people. Yeah, there. Angry.
I mean, one of the things about that is that now you have so much data being sent to you that you don't know, you know, getting the information out of it is the big thing. So then you have to start getting analysts to come in or data scientists to start looking at all of this stuff, because once you gather enough data, it's like, okay, what we're going to have to do, like run hundreds of experiments to find out, you know, what's better, you know.
I think you know, if you start off, it's the same thing, right? Start with a platform, something that's got existing stuff in it. They probably, especially if it's a game analytics platform, they probably have existing dashboards and the existing pipelines, and you can get started. You don't have to start big with game analytics. Mm-hmm. As you get to the point, like as you're talking about, Mark, where you're like, oh, I have so much data. That's a good problem to have, because that means you have a big user base. And that's where you start saying, okay, let's get some business analysts and some data analysts, right? Like, let's do some custom metrics this particular game. But in the beginning, don't stress out about it. Like, you can start with something simple.
I think my game is not going to get any data, but you know, like, all right.
But you're going to have all the data, Mark? All the data.
Yeah, I want all of it. So kind of going back full circle, so you've been working at Google Cloud, but you've, as it seems to be a tradition with yourself, open sourced a project. That's how kind of I know Mark Mundell, through open source and stuff like that. But you now have a project called Agonies. Agonies?
Doesn't matter. I'll give some background there. So first of all, yes, as we said, Mark and I know each other for a long time. We used to work in wider tech. I used to do a lot of open source stuff, as Mark did as well. And that's how we knew. And when did we start? Was it 3 years, 4 years ago? Something like that. So when I joined Google, I was coming in from general tech, had a lot of background open source experience, and got into the gaming side of things primarily because I was just like, hey, like GDC's coming up and like, just let me come play in the sandpit because games, yay, like let me please do that. And as per everything, I think, you know, they're like, you have strong opinions. Here, you own this now. So I was like, cool, ran around, talked to everyone I could find, you know, and just learned everything I could and was like, hey, this area is cool. I want to work on this. And this is something, and you know, my manager was like, that's fine, go ahead. And one thing that's kind of worked well for me in my career is being able to take stuff from another area or another community and pull it into like the new area that I'm stepping into, for example. And in this instance, what I saw is okay, looking at wider tech, open source is really prevalent. Building like these sort of open foundations of platforms and stuff is really prevalent, especially in the infrastructure side. And I understand what we call distributed systems in the WireSec for like building complicated backend systems is something I understand. But that doesn't seem to exist as much in the games community. Open source isn't nearly as big a phenomenon. It's not talked about as much. It's not a big thing. And the infrastructure side is you know, small in its education is what we're talking about. And so at the time, we weren't doing much in gaming at the time. This was like 4 or 5 years ago with Google Cloud and stuff. But I was doing a lot of work and talking to a lot of customers and talking to a lot of potential people and talking to like all that kind of stuff. And game servers, so dedicated game servers is one of the ways you can do multiplayer ones, one of my favorite ways of doing it. And there was a lot of common conversations around like, how can we do it on your platform? How do we do it in general? Most of the time we build this thing ourselves. We build these platforms and in-house and then we just kind of build it out. And you know, there was, you know, a lot of launches that some went well and a lot that didn't necessarily as well. I'm not going to pick on any particular people, but we all know game launches that failed for multiplayer stuff. And I was looking at my history and I was like, hey, this seems like this should be like a common solution for this. It seems to me, I don't want to use the word ridiculous, upsetting. It upsets me at a philosophical level that we don't have just good open tools that everyone uses for this kind of problem because so many people have solved it previously. And I also looked at, for those of you who are familiar with backend stuff, Kubernetes is probably a term you've used. It's another open source project for running big systems. I was like, that seems like a really good platform that we can build on top of to help do a lot of the heavy lifting and we can extend. Anyway, so I was chatting with some other big companies and they agreed that they wanted to do it with us. We started with Ubisoft. They also really liked the idea, so we started building this thing. And it's done really well. Embark Studios out of El Momo, Roll Table Games, if you're familiar with that, Vela Games, Jaeger. There's a bunch of other ones that I can't mention. It is entirely possible that if you've played a multiplayer game, you might have been running on my tech, which is kind of a neat thing to say in retrospect.
I mean, for a fairly young project, I mean, I say fairly young.
Yeah.
It's what, 4 years at least?
Something like that, 3 or 4 years. And also I'll use the phrase companies using is it says using. It doesn't say in production. I don't know what stage some of these people are at, so I'm not going to claim anything on that behalf. But yeah, it's been a really interesting ride to A, build. I love open source. It's something that sort of I appreciate a lot. And actually now as well, product plug a little bit, but we have a managed platform as well on top of the open source thing. So not only did I help sort of push it out into the wider community, and because of the platform, you can run it on any cloud, you can run it in all kinds of places. I was also able and privileged enough to work with our engineering and PM teams to help build a managed product on and of as well. So, but it's been a fun ride. So yeah, basically, if anyone's familiar with backend systems, it's a system for running dedicated game servers on top of Kubernetes. So basically, full game simulations, orchestrating them and managing their lifecycle because they're a bit fun and weird and interesting. And we're continuing to work on it and it's still going strong and it's good. I think we're at, how many GitHub stars are we at now? Not that that's an indication of anything real. 3,700 for
that's pretty good.
A metric that is arbitrary nice. At best.
I think one of the things just to clarify what Kubernetes is. Kubernetes
yeah,
is
yeah, we
way
can
of,
dig into it. There's a lot of stuff yeah. to dig into there that I said words yeah. that may mean things to some people.
Yeah, I mean, just on. I mean, do you want to tell what Kubernetes is for the game developers out there? Like,
yeah. So, actually, technically, if you think about it, in the grand scheme of things, a fairly young project. But essentially, if you want to run software across lots of machines, and you want to have it be an environment that is like is healthy, like if something goes wrong, it like checks it out. If you just want to do common stuff inside, very common things for like running software across lots of machines, like I have a new version and I want to distribute it across the machines and replace the one that I had before. I want to take all my logs and put it in a single place so I can do that. I want access to like, how much CPU am I using? How much memory am I using? I want to attach disks so I can store stuff in certain places, things like that. Those are all common problems we all need to solve as like software engineers.
I mean, like the common one of like, oh my God, suddenly a press release has gone out. Suddenly everyone's gone to a website that yeah. generally has 2 people going to it, now has 100,000
people. How do I scale yeah. that? And how do I do that in a cloud agnostic way and in a platform that I can run pretty much anywhere? And so Kubernetes came out. It was Google, I might get this wrong, but I think Google Red Hat, I think we're initial instigators, came out of us with a lot of other help. Since then, like everyone, just like pick a major big company has like either contributed or is hosting or involved in some way, shape or form. Powers a lot of GitHub, like all kinds of fun stuff. You can even find it in cars these days. It's a whole thing. I think I've heard talk of people putting it in airplanes. But,
listen. I mean, there's now literally cloud software in the literal clouds, right?
But it sort of comes to like, these are so the one of the things that's lovely about Kubernetes is you kind of tell it what to do, not how to do it. So you're like, hey, I need you to run 10 instances of this software and like make sure it stays up. And like if it falls down, it picks it back up, it self-heals. It does all this kind of stuff around reliability that is just really handy and just like a common use case for anything in this kind of vein. So it's become, for lack of a better term, probably a de facto platform for a lot of services for doing backend engineering stuff. I like to just call it like, just think of it as like being able to just be like, it's the self-driving car version of software. Instead of saying like I'm going to, you know, drive a stick shift on my way home and like change gears, you're just like, take me home. Just run this software for me, please. And that's a grandly simplified thing, but it's true.
Now you are making it sound like it's a switch. And we said we weren't going to do that at the beginning. It's not just a switch.
It's not just a switch.
Well, I mean, it's not just a switch.
But that's the idea.
That's the idea, yeah. Right? So you're now dealing with problems at a different layer, right? You're talking about like how to maintain application state across different servers, not how do I start up these servers? How do I go down the shop and buy a few more, you know, PCs to handle the load? And then what do I do with those PCs? Right?
Oh yeah, I remember the older sort of GameSpy days, or where you would go on to play some sort of Quake Engine game or Half-Life Engine game, and you look at the server list, and there'd be 10,000 servers there, or 2,500 servers there, and maybe about 250 of them would have players on.
Yeah,
and there were probably only about 12 that were full, and that was what an incredible waste of computing power, really.
Yeah.
To do it that way, and very very static. It's a very very static asset. It's very difficult to scale it, I imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and to John's point, like I sort of pictured Kubernetes as this magic wand, and it, in some ways it is, in some ways it isn't, and one of the reasons I think it kind of isn't is what we're seeing, especially in the last few years, is Kubernetes is a great platform for like generic software. But as soon as you're like, I want an opinionated, like efficient, streamlined workflow for how I want to build a particular type of app, anything from like web servers to anything else, you're getting these platforms that are these extensions that sit on top of Kubernetes. And Kubernetes is wonderfully extensible. It's actually kind of amazingly built. That build out these like, how do I run this particular type of workload so I don't have to worry about all these other kind of stuff, because Kubernetes can do so many things. I don't want to care about like 95% of what it does. I just want to care about the very specific part I do. And in that way, that's what a Gones is. A Gones takes Kubernetes and says, hey, let me teach you how to run game servers. Let me let you be aware of the fact that, you know, if game players aren't playing on this game server, it doesn't matter if you delete it. But if game players are playing on this game server, do not delete it, because bad Reddit comments happen and we don't want those.
So I guess with that, obviously you see it's like fully extendable and things like that. Can this be brought in like after the fact? So I've already started building the multiplayer game or anything like that. Can I transition to this system, or do I have to build my framework and basically my foundation with that at the start? Like, can I basically transition later if I just want to do a quick prototype or a quick test, but now I'm faced with that scalability problem or I want to expand? Can I switch to your system easily, I guess?
Yeah. So let me explain what Agones is and what Agones isn't as well, because this comes up a bunch. So Agones is what I refer to as it's an orchestration system. So what do I mean by that? Mm-hmm. It does not talk about like, how do you communicate between processes? We open up a UDP or TCP port and you do your thing. Like, it's up to you on how you want to do that. So we don't do network physics. We don't do multiplayer sync. Like, that's an exercise for the reader. What we do is orchestrate them. So how do you spin them up? How do you spin them down? How do you auto scale them? How do you, what we call allocation, right? How do I grab one and give it to you so you can use it as a player? Those kind of things. So if you want to do like a proof of concept where you've got like some running, like you've built your dedicated game server, right? So that's your full simulation of your game. Everyone's connecting to it. Everyone's running around and doing stuff inside that game. And you just want to host it on your machine in your QA room, like everyone connects to you. Fine. That's not going to mean anything. When you get to the point where you're like, hey, I want to host and scale this, we do have some integration type stuff for Agones that's more like, it does stuff like, hey, I'm ready, right? I've loaded all my maps or all my assets are loaded. I'm just letting you know that I'm ready. We have some other stuff where like, if you're the game server itself and you want to grab information about like, have I been allocated? Like, are players about to come to me and I need some information about that? We make that kind of stuff easy. But there are a lot of different ways that you can do that kind of integration. So to your actual answer to your question, yes, if you want to do a proof of concept and then migrate, that's totally fine. Kubernetes itself is generally a containerized system. So we use like Linux containers. So basically you probably will want a build that runs on Linux for your dedicated game server.
Right.
So that's another mitigating thing there too. And it's just an easier experience. We have a bunch of work that is in progress, depending on how much people want it, for doing stuff on Windows. Generally speaking, I usually advocate to people, unless you have a legacy system that is like reliant on Windows and it's going to take you a lot of work to move and money, if you can initially start with doing it on Linux, you're going to save a lot on like licensing costs and that kind of stuff too. And there's, there's, you know, usually I head them down that path. It's just a bit more efficient.
And actually like rental costs, like literally, like if you have a cloud and you have Windows machines on it, they're like 2-3 times the price of Linux machines as an example. So just multiply that by like your first day's peak of you going live, right? That could have cost you like 30,000 or 120, 150,000 or whatever your bill is going to be.
Generally speaking, yeah. So yeah, generally it's going to end up being a bit more expensive running on Windows. So yeah, unless you have a really good reason. Though that being said, you know, if you build your pipeline right, you could run Windows in your QA just as your quick iteration loop to get stuff done, and then have like a daily process as your Linux build, something like that, right? Like there's ways.
I mean, we should clarify, this is not saying like your game has to run on Windows, but it'd be like, for example, the server side software that you don't need to maintain on the server.
Yes.
Right. It's not like just like this is just for a Linux game, because always when people start talking platform, they get really like, oh my God, this is just for Linux players. It's like, no.
Because there's all those Linux games out there, and all those Linux gamers out there just waiting for the next big release, right?
Yeah. Actually, it's just a complete side note. So I got the opportunity to meet with some of the people who run like some of the big like LAN parties at big like gaming events and stuff through some of the work I've done with containerization and like game servers and that kind of stuff. I have to go find the GitHub repository. I'm sure if you just go look for like dockerization of like very common games that you've played, I've seen some of the most horrible things that they've done that they do successfully in terms of like, you can find on GitHub if you go looking, where like they'll run Wine inside a container to run the Windows binary, so it runs inside a Linux container, and like they can run like, I can't remember if it's true for like, but it's like games like Team Fortress or like Unreal or stuff, some stuff that generally only has the Windows binary, and they work and it's fine. And they run like, like you know, they'll have 500 people playing a game at a big game convention, you know, running inside. And so it's kind of amusing to see the hoops that people will jump through to get that stuff to work. And it works. It's fine.
That's actually really cool.
What is a Rube Goldberg machine for gaming? Yeah. That I love that.
But like gaming, it's, you know, sometimes you just, you know, you duct tape over stuff and you put some string around it and you're like, it's fine.
I think most technology, the older I get and the more systems I see, the more duct tape I have ever seen, this be it for games or for web tech. Every time you go somewhere, it's like, why is this here? It's like, oh, that was...
Don't take it away. Yeah, don't remove that duct tape. The whole thing will come crashing down.
Don't look too closely. Don't pay attention to where the seams join.
That's like any development, right? It's like, oh, there's a problem. Duct tape.
There you go.
It's fine. There you go. Yeah. It's still stable. Then you ship the game. It's fine. It just goes out and the world doesn't know any why.
And it usually goes to customer support then. That's their problem. There we go.
But yeah, to go back to the very original question, which was like talking about Agones and stuff, I think one thing that's also been really cool, and I think one of the other reasons why I'm a huge proponent of open source as well, is we've got a really good community of people working on these projects together. Like we have a Slack group and a Google group, and we do community meetings, that kind of stuff, and similar things for like there's a sibling project called OpenMatch, that's a matchmaking framework that also has similar things. And it's actually, I feel like open source has just been a wonderful tool for sharing communal ideas, best practices, design decisions, trade-offs, a lot of different people building similar games to work in the same environment and allow each other to learn from each other. So not only is it sort of been a really, I think it's just cool to build like foundational stuff that we can all take advantage of, but also have a great opportunity to share ideas. And, you know, I didn't build this alone. There was a lot of people who have worked on this. Anytime I was like, this seems like the way we should do it, you know, you write out a design ticket and you throw it out there, and you have people from a wide number of studios who are like, that's great, and that's bad, and this should be this way, and then we should change it that way. And that's fantastic. I mean, we all get to learn that.
But that's awesome. What you need, right? You need that like knowledge, that pool of like knowledge to be kind of come up with the most optimum solution. And that's the same with Facebook, like as designers on projects as well, or like programmers, artists. Like ideally, you learn from each other and you kind of pool your past experiences from past projects to come up with the best solution for whatever you're working on right now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's super cool. It's a delight.
It's kind of antithetical to what actually happens in the game industry. There's a lot of secrecy, a lot of NDAs, a lot of like, this is proprietary technology, compared to Agonis, which is like all these people going like, no, we have this problem. We're not going to tell you what we're working on. We're not telling you the game, but we need to solve it in a certain way. And people can be guided in how those problems are solved, right? Because
I agree with like what you're saying there, but I think that is something that the game industry needs to be more open to. You don't have to see what you're working on, but it's like we are ultimately day in, day out solving all of the same problems. We just don't know the other studio is trying to solve this problem. And I guess like at the end of the day, it's the characters, the story, and like the fun levels and stuff you put together. That's what makes your game unique, and that's what people play it for, right? They're not playing it for the stuff they don't see. So the behind the scenes of how your doors work, how your particle effects are firing, they just see the end result.
You had to
so
bring
that
up
stuff
doors.
Could be shared.
You had to
yeah.
bring
up. Well, the phrase I use is like I like, you know, plumbing is a great analogy for what I think makes it particularly good. Like no one's looking at your house and being like, well, I'm going to buy that house because it has great plumbing. They're only just like, if the plumbing's not there, they're like, okay, that's a problem. you know, it's everything else that goes on top. So if there are ways and means to build these plumbing type stuff that we can use, I think we're to that sort of real win. But I think it's interesting too, like you mentioned, like the secrecy in game development, and I definitely don't discount that. And that was probably a big culture shift coming into game side of things. Mm-hmm. But I also kind of laugh a little because the industry is so small and so many of us know each other. So if you want to find out how something's happening in another studio, like you can buy someone a cup of coffee or a virtual cup of coffee, depending on how things are going now, and just have a pretty frank chat. But at the same time, everyone's like, no, it's my secrets. But I'm like, but we all know what each other's doing.
Yeah.
We all know. Yeah. It's not like you're hiding that much.
Yeah. And the more people share, it's a rising tide that raises all ships, isn't it, really?
Yeah.
And that's why things like GDC and other industry events are so brilliant, because you hear about how people are solving problems that we're all going to have to solve.
Yeah, you finally get that peek behind the curtain. Every GDC, when you get that peek behind the curtain, you see it in like the games that come out beyond that point, like trends start to emerge. So the type, the way things are done, so the way pipelines are done, the way mechanics are done in games, you'll start to see them replicated like beyond that point for a few years, and then you get the same cycle happening again and again.
I feel like almost a few years ago, and some of this is still there, but like you're talking GDCs, DevComs, like that kind of stuff where you get game developer events, where people would talk about the theory of something but not the technical implementation. Like I'd see that.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is starting to change. You're getting more people who are like, okay, let me talk about the theory, and then these are the tools that we actually use to do it, which I think is great, because I think the beginning part, that's great, but often it's, you know, it's funny, it's sort of in wider tech, someone will be like, here's my talk on the thing, and someone will be like, hey, like, have you got a GitHub repository? And they're like, yeah, it's right here, it's in the notes, you can see it right here, you can just grab everything, just grab everything we just did, it's in the GitHub. Whereas you go to a game tech talk, and I've literally been in a meeting where they're like, let's talk about this topic, but we're specifically not going to mention any products by name. I'm like, why please mention products, tell me what's good and bad,
right?
I want to know.
I just saw a YouTube video from a French company that did a game, I don't want to just call them out, but and they show their tools, and they're like, they're saying like, yeah, when you work, you can do like these branching dialogues, and you can do all of the, and you can translate and see what's not translated and everything else, and it's really cool, and like the game developer can work with the narrative artist, and they show this great trailer, and at the end of it, the interviewer said like, so where can people like use this tool that looks amazing? It's like, well, you have to come and work for us.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay.
That's the catch. That's how they get you.
I feel like that might be changing a little bit. I've definitely seen more people be like, okay, we're using this thing, we're using that thing, this is the thing we used, and that kind of stuff.
I love tech art Twitter. Tech art Twitter is brilliant for the technical artists just sharing all their tips and tricks, because that's such a new kind of such a new role in game development, they don't really know how to act. They're not like programmers, you know. In the games industry, you don't share anything. No one's told them how to act, so they just share everything, which is fantastic.
Also, art is magic, as far as I'm concerned. Anyone who does that stuff is just, I don't know. It's just magic.
Wizards. This is wizards.
Same with audio engineers. No idea how any of that works. Just make things sound good. Okay, cool. Thank you.
It's what I've gotten into enough conversations because of podcasts and everything else about the audio, and like, I think I get to a point and goes like, and my eyes have gone cross-eyed. I have no idea what you're talking. Like, you had me at to one point and then like gone. But Mark, that's been an enlightening talk. I've said this before, but that was with a lightning artist. This has been a mind expanding talk. There you go. You have increased my mental.
Always got to get the joke in somehow. Always got to get the joke in somehow.
There we go. I'm trying. So if people want to know more about Agones, they could go to agones.dev, right?
That's right. Follow us on Twitter at agonesdev.
I'll put the links in the show notes. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, go for it. It's great. It's my name. There you go. And if they want to follow the other Mark, they can if they want.
It's choice. You can do what you like. Joining Twitter in 2006, I have the handle @neurotic, which is an old IRC handle that I used to have when I was 15.
Nice.
I've always been jealous of your handle.
Reasons. And very occasionally I throw stuff on YouTube and Twitch. So I'm talking about doing open source development for backend stuff. So YouTube is Mark S. Mandel and Twitch is Mark Mandel, just to be confusing. Or just go to my Twitter account and you can find all the links.
All the show notes.
On the show notes. We're pointing down at that.
Definitely, yes. Go to the show notes. Yeah, that's the better place. Do that.
Yeah. I better remember to put some show notes on this, because otherwise people are going to be very, very mad. And don't be mad, be happy, enjoy, like the episode. Leave us a comment on wherever you got this episode from. I mean, if it's, you know, Shady Guy down the road or whoever, just give us a like and all of those things.
Is that how podcasts are distributed now? This is a Shady Guy in a street corner somehow giving out audio files.
Man, marketing, my friend. You know, you got to pay for marketing. You got to get the word out. Doesn't matter how. I've got people giving out CDs and USB sticks. It's like, that's how we spread.
It's good to know.
And on that note, I hope you've enjoyed this USB-driven episode, and have a good night. Good night.
Bye.
Good night.
The Level Design Podcast has been a Command Studio production. Our editor is Matthew Lever, and this episode has been produced by Bridie Rose.